Tonight, let's go to Esther chapter 8. Tonight is one of those lessons when you want to say, do you want to try to finish Esther tonight, or should we divide it into two parts? And I think even if we end up a little bit early, that we will handle it, chapter 8 tonight, some observations off of chapter 8 that we can take and isolate in that little compartment in our head so it will never bother us, but we'll be thrilled at the moment. And then we'll cover chapter 9, finish out the book on Wednesday evening. Essentially, in chapter 8, the groundwork, the legal groundwork for the delivery of God's people, the Jews, is now laid out. And in chapter 9, they are going to have to fight in order to protect themselves, in order to keep from being annihilated. And God is simply going to say, the method whereby you deliver yourself is going to be the sword. And in looking through that, I just picked up some notes I don't particularly want to give when we get to chapter 9, but they're just some things I wrote down. These have got to be a good 12 or 13 years ago about the lack of courage to really stand on our own feet and defend ourselves. And I had clipped three things from the scene back then. One was a speech made by Kingman Brewster to Congress. I believe he was at that time, Kingman Brewster is associated with Harvard or Yale. Yale? Okay, doesn't make a difference. But at any rate, as he addressed Congress, and it was in a period of, the late 60s when we had all kinds of radicalism in the streets and so forth, and here is a message of a very courageous man to Congress. Quote, surrender. If we don't give hardcore radicals what they want, they will burn the country down. Can we let that happen? No. So quit. Give up. Surrender. And that, again, is an illustration. If this had been the mentality in chapter 9 of Esther, the Jews would have been annihilated. It's a little article when Robert Finch was welfare secretary. And again, this is newspaper reports, so I don't know. But nonetheless, for whatever it's worth, reported that a gang of insolent people occupied his office, ousted him from his chair, put their feet on his desk, and proceeded to belabor him with 3 hours of abuse. What did he do? The paper says. He was calm. He never raised his voice. He attempted to reason with them. And again, if we had that kind of mentality behind the book of Esther, that is simply surrender and give in to everything, you wonder. Another one which I'd clipped was from the Federal Commission on Obscenity and Pornography, and a witness, Thomas, and he wasn't around, I guess, enough to even remember the name, F-A-R-C-A-D-E, whoever that was, however that might be pronounced, came in spouting obscenities and ended by throwing a pie in the face of a witness, Dr. Larson. What did Dr. Larson do, the paper says? He wiped the pie off his suit, made no attempt to have the man arrested, and in essence, apologized for being in front of the pie. So with that kind of leadership mentality, and I'm afraid we may not be too far removed from it, thank God for men like Schwarzkopf that don't quite think that way and probably would not apologize for being in front of a pie. That kind of character, and we'll find in Esther chapter 9 that God is going to say, you want to be free, then you're going to have to fight the Persians, you're going to have to defend yourself, else you end up on their sword. But let's notice the preparation for it, chapter 8, and then get some conclusions. Chapter 8 is essentially preparation for delivery. All of the things getting set up that will come together to deliver God's people. Preparation for delivery. And just in order to kind of link the content together, and we'll go through it in three parts, but let me show you the blocks that make it up. Essentially, the first block is going to deal with Mordecai's exaltation. Mordecai's exaltation. And that is found in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Reading. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. That is, she was his cousin. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the throne of Haman. So, first part, his exaltation, or Mordecai's new position. And in thinking of that new position, we are going to find there will be four features to it. Four features of that brand new position. We'll come back to them. As soon as he is exalted, you have Mordecai's solution. What are we going to do for the condemned people? And his solution runs in chapter 8, verses 3 through 14. And that will revolve about three major things: Esther's petition, the king's reply, and then Mordecai's decree, which will go under this heading. Finally, we come down, and we could call that, if we would call the first one Mordecai's exaltation or the new position, then this is the new decree or new edict. And we will find that that decree will not replace the one made under Haman, but it will provide a means whereby it may be overruled. Third segment is going to be Mordecai's impact on Persia. And the impact will be chapter 8, verses 15 through the end of the chapter, verse 17. And if the first part is his new position, the second part is his new decree, and now his new influence. And in essence, that influence will be so strong that we are going to have people, quote, end quote, converting en masse. Whether genuine or not is not the point. The point is a lot of people became Jews under the impact of Mordecai. So that, in essence, then, is the outline of the chapter. And now let's go back and break it down into those parts. Number one, exaltation. And make a few notes underneath that. Chapter 8, verses 1 and 2. Four things will happen. Number one, Mordecai received Haman's wealth. Mordecai received Haman's wealth. Point one and verse one. And that is expressed in the following words. On that day, King Xerxes gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And the whole concept then is his house was given to another. The word house is synonymous with estate. And within the state were both objects and people, household servants. We do not think of an estate in terms of the possession of people, but within the state of Haman, he had lots of servants, male and female servants. He had many objects of wealth. He had much money. And all of that is now given over to the house of, given to Esther, who in turn passed it to Mordecai. At this point, we might enter a point of law in Persia. In Persia, the state had the right to confiscate. The law had the right to confiscate the property of condemned criminals or the estate of condemned criminals. In chapter 7, Haman has been condemned and he has been hanged, which means he was treated as a condemned criminal. And thus, by Persian law, the estate that remained was taken by the state. If that were parallel today, if someone were executed for murder, for example, the estate would not go to their family, it would not go to their relatives, it would not follow the next of kin. And if you've ever read through some law in terms of that, even our laws have a lot of complex about what the hierarchy is in terms of how the property passes to this person, then to this, then to this, and this. And it can become a very complicated matter so that to determine that, many times you need legal advice or an attorney that can explain the laws of inheritance and who the property passes to when one person dies. The Persians swept all that under the cover, and they said, if a person is a condemned criminal, we put him to death, and then the state takes his property. And consequently, this is what's happened in this particular context. Notice that it took place no long probate court by any means, because the chapter opens by saying, on that day, what day? Verse 10 of chapter 7. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he'd prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided, and on that very day, Xerxes gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. Quick transaction under Roman law, so the state had the right to do so, and also the transfer was immediate. There was no court procedure. The transfer was immediate and automatic. When the man is hanged, the estate goes to the state, and it was an automatic matter. Just to get a little idea of what kind of estate or what kind of wealth did he have, go back to chapter 5 and verse 11. It must have been fairly considerate. Chapter 5, verse 11. Chapter 8 does not tell anything about the size of the estate, but chapter 5, verse 11 gives a hint that it must have been significant. Chapter 5, verse 11, then Haman recounted to them, that his friends and his wife, the glory of his riches. That would be the idea of the richness of his riches. And the number of his sons were all under his household now. And every instance where the king had magnified him, he had many honors, and how he had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the king. So we do know that whatever Mordecai got in terms of wealth, it had to be significant. Second, not only did he receive Haman's wealth, but second, he received Haman's position. One, his wealth. Two, his position. And where do we find that? We find that also in verse 1. On the day King Xerxes gave the house, i.e., the wealth of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther, and Mordecai, and here's the second item, came before the king. And that is a reference to his very exalted position. And therefore, came before the king. Pictured an elite group. Remember, we mentioned that part of Persian law is you could never come before the king unbidden. You could never come unannounced, except for an elite few. The elite few are referred to in 110, 114, 7-9, and here in 8-1. Came before does not mean put in his appearance. It means he was free whenever he chose and under whatever circumstances just to walk in. In other words, he had an open entree to the king whenever he wanted it. A few people had that. Going back to chapter 1, verse 10. Think of him now being placed as a member of an elite few. 1:10 refers to them. Upon the giving of the banquet, on the seventh day, verse 10 reads, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Havona, Bagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of the king. And that means they had access to his presence without being called. Verse 14 speaks of these men and says they were close to him, Karshena, Shetha, and I'm not going to read them all, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and set in the place of the kingdom. And then when you come over to chapter 7 and verse 9, then Harbona one of the eunuchs who were before the king, and it means elite position to come in before him. And notice when Haman is deposed in chapter 8, verse 1, that day King Xerxes gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther, and Mordecai came before the queen. And therefore came before elite group who had access to the king at will. Okay, two things have happened then. Mordecai's on the way up. He's got Haman's wealth. He's got Haman's position. And third, he received Haman's power. Received Haman's power. The receiving of the king's power is expressed in verse 2. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And therefore, to hold the ring is to hold the power to act in the king's name. To hold the ring is power to act in his name, or in the king's name, that is now transferred from dead Haman to living Mordecai. I think it's very interesting that both of these men had the king's signet ring and both could act in the king's name, but we ought to notice Haman and Mordecai used it in different ways. And it is interesting that power inevitably can be used for the good or the bad. Haman used this power to destroy God's people. Mordecai had the same power, only he used it to save God's people. So, what should we say? Is power good or is power bad? You can't answer that. Power for Haman was bad, but it was in the hands of an evil man. Power for Mordecai was good, because it was in the hands of a good man. But it's an interesting study in how power was totally used differently by both men. Number four. He received Haman's office. And in the last part of verse 2, Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And I think probably the best way to put it is this man is now prime minister of Persia, the leading authority of state, prime minister of Persia, next to the king and trusted by the king. Now that probably included the treasury department. If you go back to chapter 3 and verse 11, I'll show you the reason for saying that, why it probably included the treasury. Chapter 3, verse 10, the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the silver is yours. And the people also, to do with them, that is, the people and the silver, as you please. So it's very possible, then, that when he comes into the office, or Mordecai comes into the office of prime minister, this included the power over the treasury of the king that is there. So essentially, then, part one of chapter 8, exaltation of Mordecai. Now, with all that exaltation of Mordecai and Esther, what position does this put the Jews in? Not one thing in the world is different. They're still going to be annihilated. And thus, we have a second part of chapter 8 that will begin to weave how the salvation of Mordecai and Esther is going to reach the Jews. So, for the problem, we have Mordecai's solution. Eight, 3-14. And we begin with Esther's petition. Verses 3-6. Now let me give you the way some people teach, and I say this because there's, I guess, a significant amount that do. They teach that in verse 3, Esther risks her life the second time. And thus, reading verse 3, then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. And the king extended the golden scepter to Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. And therefore, let's put in, because if you ever heard it taught or read or read about it in commentaries, we need to answer, is this a second risk of her life? Those that say yes will argue this way, that when you saw the king's scepter extended, that's the same thing that happened before. She came uninvited, she took the risk, he lifted his scepter, and she was accepted. And they say, well, isn't this the same thing right here? She came, wanted to go into the presence of the king, the presence of the king did the same thing he did last time, he lifted the scepter, and therefore this girl has risked her life for the second time. And it's based on the raised scepter. It is the same thing as what happened before. I don't think, if you take it that way, it's no big deal. But to me, the raised scepter, this time, was not a response to her entry. It was a response to her tears. It was raised in response to her emotion. In other words, it did not signal the right of entry. It did not signal the right of entry. It did signal the need to arise from her prostrate position. It did signal the need to rise. In other words, he's not responding to her entry, is responding to her tears. And I think that's well borne out in verse 3. She falls at his feet. Doesn't that imply she's already in his presence? Wept at his feet and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he devised against the Jews. So you've got her prostrate before the king at his feet, pleading for delivery. Then the king extends his golden scepter to Esther, and what does she do? It does not say she entered, it says she rose. She stood in front of the king. So this is probably his response to the passionate, emotional appeal that Esther makes in verse 3. Now the important thing to note at this point with her request is this. Esther, at this point, Esther and Mordecai are safe. The Jews are not. Esther, Mordecai is now safe. Jews are not. And that is in verse 6. She says, how can I endure to see the calamity which shall befall my people? How can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? And thus she's fully recognizing, I'm safe, Mordecai's safe, but the Jews are not safe. And thus, to Esther's petition, we get the king's reply. Her petition, and now the king's reply. And the king's reply is an 8, 7, and 8. And notice in verse 7 and 8 that the reply of the king focuses on two decrees, the old one by Haman and the new one by Mordecai. Verse 7, so King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther. Him we've hanged on the gallows because he stretched out his hands against the Jews. Now write to do to the Jews as you see fit. In the king's name, seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed in the king's signet ring may not be revoked. And the important thing at this point is to note that the old decree, and that was on this day, you may destroy Jews. And if we miss this, we're missing a major lesson of the text. The old decree was not altered. Not only did the king not alter it, he couldn't. And issued in the law of the Medes and the Persians was the Jews are going to be annihilated. And without in any way altering that decree, the king is going to say, Mordecai, word it however you want to. Can you word some kind of law that will invalidate the other? So the issue was, you say, what did a king of Persia do when he made a decree and it had to be carried out and he wanted to back out? Was there any way? Well, would you believe that men are always skillful at finding loopholes? And so were the Persian kings, and therefore the principle was this. We cannot alter the original decree. However, can we do this? Can we issue another that will invalidate or that will disable, that's better, that will disable the first? We can't change the first. We can't alter the first, but can we do something that will disable it? And therefore, into the context, we are going to have the disabling decree. And that is spoken of in chapter 9. We have to move a little bit ahead. Chapter 9. This is the disabling decree. The first decree and the second decree, the one by Haman, the one by Mordecai, are to be fulfilled on the same day. Chapter 9. Now in the 12th month, that is the month Adar, on the 13th day when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, notice no alteration, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those that hated them. And we will find out that the decree of Mordecai said, you can fight for yourself, and you can prepare for yourself, and you got the king's backing. So then the major lesson that's going to come along is going to be this. The power of the old decree was rendered ineffective not by ignoring it, but it was rendered ineffective by those who would avail themselves of the new decree. Made ineffective by those who would avail themselves of the new decree. And in order to do so, you had to fight. And the decree is going to say, are you willing to kill Persians? If you're willing to kill Persians in defense of yourself, then that old decree can be made ineffective. But notice, the whole salvation and delivery was done legally. Whatever we may think of the irrevocable law of the Medes and the Persians, nonetheless, everything was done in a perfectly legal matter. And that follows then with point three after the reply, is Mordecai says, okay, I will issue a decree. And we have Mordecai's decree, 9 through 14. And that decree has several points to it. It's, in essence, found in chapter 8 and verse 11. In this new decree, it says, the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble, to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate the entire army of any people or province who might attack them, including children, women, and to plunder their spoil. So notice several things then that are now given in this decree. The right to fight was backed by the throne, so that the latest decree said, when we fight for our freedom, we have the backing of the king. Which meant, if you had the kind of mentality to go ahead and try and fill out the first decree, you're fighting Xerxes. And the average person knows or knew that would not be a healthy move. Notice, this is also more than self-defense. This is more than self-defense that is here. It is corporate advanced preparation. Corporate advanced preparation. You can get all your Jewish friends, gather them together in an army, and you can prepare for. It's not just you defend your house, you defend yourself. You get together and you can defend one another's house. In other words, sort of the creation of an army. And notice they were also given the right to use any and all force, including anybody, women, men, children, including anything, take their property, and you can get rid of them any way you want. Kill, destroy, annihilate. In other words, there were no restrictions. You have the right to corporately defend yourself as Jews, and I put no restrictions whatsoever on you. No restrictions. Or, to put it without repeating, and I think the last one has essentially been a repeat, they were given the right to arm for common defense. Arms for common defense. Don't you wonder if there were any pacifists that ended up with a lovely Persian sword with diamonds and pearls in the handle shoved in their chest? I don't know whether there was any or not. We don't know that there were. It doesn't seem like there were. But the point is, you have your freedom as a nation if you will fight to maintain your freedom. And that is how God's providence. Notice God's providence does not set aside a human means. I will provide your salvation. Now, you're going to have to go out and fight your own battle in order to win this if you wish to protect it. All right, the final part before we get to observation is Mordecai's decree, Mordecai's impact. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes, blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. Kind of implies the people knew what the king wanted, doesn't it? For the Jews, there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And in each and every province, each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and the decree arrived, there was a gladness of joy for the Jews and a feast and a holiday. And many of the people of the land became... Now, you can do this either one of two ways you want to. If you think that they did this purely out of fear, then the text ought to read, many of the people of the land became, quote, Jews, end quote. Meaning that they did that. And they had a provision of Persian law whereby if you were in danger, you could convert. You didn't have to convert in your heart, but you convert outwardly. If you think that's the case, then it ought to be Jews in quotes. If you think it's a sincere conversion, then leave it as we have it. They became Jews genuinely, or they became Jews externally. For the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. Now, one note I think we want to make on that, was that dread natural or supernatural? And we ought to add a couple of passages that I think will help us at least set a precedent for this. And the first is Exodus 15, 16. And second, Deuteronomy 11, 25. And both of these show that God often worked for his people by supernaturally scaring the enemy to death. And one of the things that the crossing of the Red Sea is Israel felt that God placed on the Egyptians a supernaturally imposed fear. Exodus 15, 16. And notice as chapter 15 begins, this is a song of praise. They've come through the Red Sea. They're singing praise to the Lord. Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he's highly exalted. The horse and its rider describing the Egyptian forces. He has hurled into the sea and so forth down through till you get to verse 16. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of thy arm, they are motionless as stone. So notice this is not natural fear. God's arm has scared them to the point that they can't move. They're frozen in their tracks, and that's a supernatural. Even clearer is Deuteronomy 11:25. Deuteronomy 11:25. And notice you have a promise to the nation that as they go against their enemies, that God would place on their enemies a fear. Chapter 11, verse 25 reads, There shall no man be able to stand before you. The Lord your God shall lay the dread of you and the fear of you on all the land which you set foot, as he spoken to you. And with those promises of the code of Deuteronomy, it's very hard to believe that into the event that closes chapter 9 of Esther, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them, this was not a supernatural act. Now, closing out chapter 8, observations. Lessons to learn, application of the truth found here. A couple of observations about Esther and Mordecai. And one is this, a true leader. A true leader does not allow his own security to obscure the plight of his own people. True leader does not allow his own security to cause him to neglect the peril of his people. As a matter of fact, he cannot enjoy his own security because of the plight of his people. And that's very clearly made, is it not, in chapter 8 and verse 6? Here is this woman who is saved, who has the wealth of the prime minister, who is exalted as anybody could ever be. She is the queen. Her cousin is in power. She's got everything. She is secure. She is safe. She is wealthy. But notice her mental attitude in verse 6. How can I endure to see the calamity which shall befall my people? And how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Her own security did not blind her to the plight of those that she led. True leaders are never self-serving. A good leader are never self-serving. Mordecai and Esther could have both forgotten about Jews, lived securely and happy, and in a wealthy state the rest of their life. But that's not a leader. Observation number two. The two decrees illustrate salvation. The two decrees illustrate salvation in the following way. First, the decree of Haman. And second, the decree of Mordecai. One, as the decree of Haman, so, as the decree of Haman, so the law of God. Irrevocable. Did God, in providing our salvation, relax His law of justice? The answer to that is absolutely not. Does Haman's decree illustrate that? It certainly does, doesn't it? The salvation of the Jews did not come about by the relaxing of the law that they would have to be annihilated. That remained in place. And thus our first comparison. Second comparison. As the decree of Haman was a decree of death, so, God's law. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 9. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 9. And here we've got Paul making a comparison between two covenants and the aim of what each did. Verse 6, God has made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter or the law, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. But if the ministry of death in letters engraved on stones came with glory, so that the sons of Israel could not look intently at the face of Moses because of the glory of his face, fading as it was, how shall the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even more glory? For if the ministry of condemnation has glory, much more the ministry of righteousness abounds in glory. And just as the decree of Haman was a decree of death, so it illustrates. I did not say foreshadows or is a type of, but it does illustrate that truth. Moving to the second decree, which is the decree of Mordecai. How does it illustrate salvation? One, as Mordecai's decree was rooted in the grace of the king, in favor of the king, so salvation is rooted in grace. What and why do we say that the decree of Mordecai was rooted in grace? Why did he get to make it? Because when Esther went in, the king did what? The king lifted his scepter and says, I approve. And therefore, like the scepter of the king was lifted, saying, the decree of Mordecai, the request of Esther, can now be fulfilled. So salvation also roots in grace. Two, the decree of Mordecai was made possible by the death of Haman. So, point of comparison, salvation is possible because of the death of Christ. Mordecai would have never made his decree if Haman had lived. We won't turn to it, but Hebrews 2, 14, 15. Third point of comparison. As the decree of Mordecai required appropriation by fighting, as the decree of Mordecai required appropriation by fighting, so, point of comparison, salvation by appropriation through faith. Fourth, as the decree of death was written, so the decree of the gospel, or the proclamation of the gospel, the decree or perhaps the proclamation of death was written, and the means of salvation was also written. Fourth observation. Third observation, I guess. Third. True dedication to service, desires salvation beyond oneself. Mordecai and Esther desired salvation of those beyond themselves. Parallel passage such as Romans 9, 1 through 3, Romans 10, 1, where Paul says, I would that I could be cut off or damned for my people. And how he prays and his heart's desire is the salvation of Israel. Paul did not allow salvation to cause him to draw into cocoon where he cared for no one else but himself. Same is true and illustrated by Esther. Fifth, every believer has an obligation of sympathy and support, for those of the faith who are oppressed. Every believer has the obligation of sympathy and support for those of the faith who are oppressed. I'll give you passages. And we will divide that into what it's based on and two, what it's commanded by. What do you think the reason for sympathy for a fellow believer is based on? It's based on body truth. And you might add to that passages or critical passage such as 1 Corinthians 12 and 25 through 27 where it argues that the body is one. When one part of the body hurts, the whole body hurts. It's commanded by passages such as 1 Peter 3:8 about tenderheartedness and sympathy, and passages Galatians 6:10, same thing, and 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 13 and 14, where Paul says, the saints at Jerusalem are suffering need, and I expect you all to pick up that need so there'll be an equality in the body of Christ. Fifth principle, the truest unity is among God's people. The truest unity is spiritual, not physical. And I searched. I looked for 20 minutes trying to find this passage, and I couldn't find it. Maybe some of you recall it. It's where the mother and brothers of Jesus want to see him. And they think they have priority because of the physical blood relationship. And Jesus comes back and says, who is my brother or my father and my mother except those that do the will of God? And I think it's kind of Johnny-like. But I couldn't find it there, so I must have been looking for the... You recognize that is a passage, right? Okay, if you recognize that is a passage, then it's in the Bible. Okay, six. Most delivery uh, brought by God. Utilizes human means, a means of some sort. The chapter 9, we'll find out they had to sharpen their swords. They had to have them with them. They had to know how to use them. And it's an illustration of how God brings delivery. And it is His delivery, but it is by means of that which is human that is brought about. All right, chapter 9 then, and we'll close Esther now for sure on Wednesday, as the nation fights for its delivery and is delivered by God. Father, we're thankful today once again for the truth of your word in Christ's name. Amen.